Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, we're going to have a terrific show for you. We have as our guest the editor of the leading journal of opinion in the United States and arguably the leading journal for the past 142 years. Our guest will be Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation magazine. But first, before we go to Katrina Vandenhoevel, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
At a Senate hearing last week, the public learned that the Federal Communications Commission chairman, Kevin Martin, had plans to rush through sweeping changes to the nation's longstanding media ownership rules by the end of the year. But North Dakota Senator Byron Dorgan had a message for Martin.
The last time the commission did this, they decided in the largest American cities, it was perfectly fine for the Federal Communications Commission rule for one entity to own 8 radio stations, 3 television stations, the cable company, and the dominant newspaper. And that was just fine. Well, I'll tell you what, it sure ain't fine with me. If this is where the FCC is headed, there's going to be a firestorm of protests, and I'm going to be carrying the wood.
Kevin Martin initiated a new review of the rules in the summer of 2006. He committed to hold at least 6 public hearings on ownership, complete a proceeding on localism, and conduct independent studies on the impact of consolidation on local news and female and minority ownership. But Dorgan criticized that process.
There has not been a conclusion on localism. There's not been a conclusion on the proceedings of public interest. There is not possibly time by December to come out with the new media ownership rules out of the FCC and give any fairness to any group of people in this country to have the opportunity to comment on rules.
After the hearing, Dorgan co-authored a letter to Martin with Republican Senator Trent Lott of Mississippi, urging the FCC to slow down and consider all the facts before making any decisions. When Martin announced the final localism hearing would be held on October 31st in Washington, D.C., Dorgan and Lott pledged to overturn any new rules.
This is a big deal. We have way too much concentration of ownership in this country now. Way too much. And the suggestion that we should allow greater concentrations of television station owners, greater concentration of radio owners. I come from a state in which one company bought all 6 radio stations in one of our little towns. One company. And then to boot, let's throw in cross-ownership and let newspapers buy up radio and TV stations buy up newspapers. We'll all have a great time. Well, I'll tell you what, I think that's counterproductive to the public interest in this country.
To find out more about the media ownership issue, go to stopbigmedia.com.
The Associated Press recently exposed Comcast for blocking broadband subscribers who tried to upload files via a file-sharing network called BitTorrent. Not only did Comcast block the traffic, but it used a deceptive technique to disguise what it was doing. BitTorrent may not be an everyday internet application for many people, yet. It is meant for moving big files across the net quickly and cheaply. Adam Lin, policy coordinator for Free Press, explains.
When you normally download something off the internet, you go to a website, you click on a link, and it starts downloading. And where it's downloading from is a server, which the website pays for their content to be stored on and pays for upload speed. And what BitTorrent does is it distributes out that task of getting people the information. So the person who created the content doesn't have to pay such high fees and hosting costs to have it on a website.
Applications like BitTorrent are best known for quickly downloading movies and other entertainment files. But Lynn says many businesses and other users are starting to recognize the value of this type of file sharing because it is a very efficient way to transfer information. Comcast claims they are simply managing the network to ensure a good quality service, but the evidence suggests otherwise. For one, Comcast's technology doesn't target individual users. It targets everyone using an application Comcast doesn't like. Secondly, Comcast's technology falsely impersonates its customers to intercept the transmissions. Such deceptive practices may be illegal and are a clear violation of network neutrality. Why would Comcast resort to such underhanded measures? Numerous content providers in Hollywood have contracted with BitTorrent to make their online programming available for downloading. As the internet grows and consumers understand how the quality and quantity of their video files can improve, file sharing will be an important part of moving web traffic, and Comcast views all this peer-to-peer sharing as competition to their own business model.
The long-term investment to build out your network, you're going to drive demand by doing that, not by inhibiting what customers can do online, by increasing what they can do online.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national, nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have a show that I've been looking forward to. One of our most popular guests is rejoining us, Katrina VandenHeuvel, editor of The Nation since 1995, publisher since 2005. Katrina VandenHeuvel's edited numerous books. I won't go through them all, but you can find her work by reading The Nation every week or by going to thenation.com and looking for her weblog called Editor's Cut, which is well worth reading. Katrina VandenHeuvel also, I'm delighted to say, is the co-editor at one time of VMY, a Russian-language feminist newsletter. Katrina, you never cease to amaze me. What is the story of VMY?
You know, before I became editor, Bob, I spent many years living and reporting from Moscow, and part of my work there was in founding, along with Russian women, a quarterly newsletter called VMY, but you and we. And it was an attempt to share ideas, experiences, lessons, models between American and Russian women. And that was a wonderful experience, and it sort of had a front seat at the beginnings of a women's movement in the modern-day Russia.
What years was this roughly, Katrina?
Well, I started going to Moscow in 1978, so I've had a chance to see the changes, so to speak. But I had the best period, Bob, was from 1985 to 1993, my husband, Stephen Cohen, who's a Russia expert and who was also a contributing editor of The Nation, we had a chance to be on the front lines of a country which was undergoing extraordinary changes, which people here may remember as Perestroika and Glasnost. And I worked at a Russian-language newspaper, the Moscow News, covering the first parliamentary elections and covering some of the emerging candidates and, you know, the sort of reformers who were coming out of that period, and watching an editor every day, every week, the weekly newspaper, cross the street to haggle with the still existing censorship.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an interesting example, because though we don't have what it was called in Moscow then, Glavlit, which is the official censorship agency, we have our own problems with, you know, self-censorship and what you've written about, Bob, the sort of corporate structure of our media, which doesn't serve our democracy too well.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Russia while we're on the topic, before we come to the United States and talk about politics here, which will be the crux of the show today. But one of the things you periodically do write about Russian politics still in your blog and in the magazine, and The Nation still covers that beat as much as anyone does in the United States today. And, you know, one of the jokes I recall from the mid-1990s going around was, you know, what has capitalism accomplished in 5 years in Russia that communism couldn't accomplish in 70 years? And the punchline was, make communism look good.
That's right.
And, you know, that was in the mid-90s, and that was when there had been that tremendous free fall in the gross domestic product of Russia, and the standard of living had plummeted, and all these terrible things were happening sort of with the Russian economy. That was a decade ago. You go back periodically. What's happened in the last decade in Russia? What is the nature of its political economy today?
You know, Bob, you cannot understand today's Russia, Putin's Russia, without understanding Yeltsin and Yeltsinism. I mean, I think your listeners remember Boris Yeltsin, the sort of outsized, flamboyant Russian leader. The American media narrative about Yeltsin and Yeltsinism was that democracy was coming to Russia, and you're going to have free market capitalism, and all would be hunky-dory. And as so often with the American media narrative, it was seeking in Russia what it wanted to find instead of reporting on the realities. 60% of the country plunged into poverty, a shock therapy program imposed partly by the West leading Russians to equate democracy with pain, hardship, and poverty, and the creation of an oligarchical class, which we, you know, now see the remnants of in Putin's Russia. I don't think Putin, who is, as the nation said when he first came to power, and your listeners should know, he was basically came to power, first thing he did was give Yeltsin and his family immunity from prosecution. We knew he was an authoritarian figure. He emerged from the KGB. Interestingly, places like The Economist, The Financial Times, The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post at that time welcomed him, thinking he was someone you could do business with. Now, Russia, how to just... One of the oligarchs, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, is in prison. I don't think he should be behind bars, but I do think these oligarchs should be taxed to the ceiling, and I think Putin needed to reassert state control over oil and gas and the rich resources of a country that were given away in the greatest fire sale of the 20th century by Yeltsin, with complicity in some ways by the West. So Russia today is a country that is more stable. The media, which I follow, is under siege, and I'll stop, Bob, but the television is state-controlled. But, and it's a longer conversation, I could make the case and argue it out that in Moscow on any given day, in the print press, you have a broader spectrum of spirited, lively opinion than you do sitting in New York City, looking just at the newspapers. And one of those newspapers, Novaya Gazeta, is a wonderful oppositionist paper, which is where the journalist Anna Politkovskaya worked, who was murdered October 7th of last year. And, you know, the state and future of independent journalism in Russia is something of great concern. What encourages me is a few months ago, 2,000 journalists organized themselves to petition the Russian government to stop the rollback of regional papers, of regional press, of independent media. And I think when Russian journalists organize themselves, that is the greatest thing, instead of Western lecturing and hectoring. So I hope they find the killers. I hope Novaya Gazeta continues to be the oppositionist muckraking paper it is without threats. And interestingly enough, Gorbachev, Mikhail Gorbachev, the former Soviet leader, owns 10% of that paper, which is an interesting marker for someone who I think regrets what's happened to Glasnost, which was a policy he so championed, freedom, you know, freedom, lifting of censorship, freedom of the press.
Is there any sort of political left in Russia today, any, not necessarily remnant of the communist left, but even of a sort of an independent libertarian left, to use a different term to distinguish it from the Communist Party days, or is the political culture pretty much devoid of those sort of markers?
Good question. I mean, what Putin has done is sort of taken over so much of the political space in that country. The Kremlin has just formed a new party called, interestingly, Just Russia, meaning like justice and equality. The reason they formed that party, which is a, you know, Kremlin party, is they understand that if there is a prevailing popular ideology in Russia today, it is nationalism allied with a kind of left-wing populist economics. There is a very small left, located maybe in the trade union movements, among students. What is interesting, though, is there is the emergence of an opposition, which is an unholy troika of sorts, with the former chess champion, Garry Kasparov. But in that coalition is a man named Edward Lamonov, and we're doing an article about this, whose party is called the National Bolshevik Party. It's an odd, unfortunate name in some ways, but what he has is a lot... Do you want me to, is that real noisy, Bob, that siren?
Well, I think it's giving our listeners a taste of life in the big city.
You know, this street is very noisy today. Anyway, but Edward Lamonov is a kind of in the streets, in your face, has great attention among young people who kind of like that civil disobedience in the streets. And, you know, the ideology is a left-wing economics allied with a nationalism. And as we both know, nationalism can have its underside. The Communist Party, by the way, is still probably the largest oppositionist party, but it has, you know, great problems. It has a much older membership. It is allied increasingly with nationalistic, xenophobic qualities. And though it maintains a left-wing economic stance, it's not growing. It's not growing. So it's an odd landscape, and I regret to say at the moment, partly because Putin has taken over so much of the political space, it's hard to see a real left emerging in any electoral way or even in any strong movement way yet.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Katrina Vandenhul, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine based out of New York City. And we're talking to Katrina today. We're taping this show during the week, so that's why you heard New York's finest up and down the streets of Lower Manhattan as we were just speaking with her. We've been talking about Russia. Katrina Vandenhul has lived in Russia and is an expert in Russian politics. But now we're going to turn our attention to The Nation and to American politics today and in the coming years. I want to remind our listeners here to Media Matters on WILL AM 580 that we're recording the show before going on air, so please don't try to call in today. Just sit back, relax, and let Katrina Vandenhul and yours truly do the yakking. Katrina, for some of our listeners who might not be familiar with The Nation, maybe you could just give a little bit of The Nation's history and some sense of what the magazine is like.
The Nation, Bob, was founded in 1865 by abolitionists committed to the abolition of slavery. One of its founders was the architect of Central Park, by the way. But it's always marched to a different drummer. It has been opposed to military solutions to crises. It speaks to a sense of social justice, of equality, of a sense that there are alternatives in our history and politics and society that have not been followed, partly because these views, which the Nation have espoused, you know, get suppressed at different times. Mm-hmm. And we're always challenging the mainstream, we're challenging the limits, and we speak to the possibility of a different America and speak to the possibility of an America engaged with the world in a different way, certainly today. Independence is our hallmark, critical-mindedness, and at a time, something you write about so well, Bob, at a time of unprecedented media consolidation, we, you know, revel in our independence to speak our mind and to be a place for intelligent discussion, conversation, and a forum for different views on the left, also among liberals, progressives, anarchists, even conservatives with a conscience. So that's sort of the role the Nation occupies. And we have a very active website in these last years, understanding that, you know, a lot of debate and discussion goes on the web, but also important for us that our views and voice and ideas are amplified through the web, because it can go to, you know, it can go to Argentina, it can go to Owensboro, Kentucky, it can go everywhere in ways that the print product sometimes can't.
Now, Katrina Vandenhul, The Nation in recent years, at least I've been a reader now for going 35 years now, approximately, to the early 70s. But it has it is a liberal and left publication. It really straddles a broad range of the political spectrum. And sometimes that's a difficult range to traverse with both legs comfortably on the ground. What is the relationship of The Nation to the Democratic Party?
The Nation, we are interested in exploring and reporting on the limits of the Democratic Party, on the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, as Senator Paul Wellstone put so well and then Howard Dean picked up. And we're interested in how it might be revived, because it's in so many ways a kind of money shell as opposed to a place where ideas or people are engaged. But we're also very critical of the Democrats at moments when it is called for. We are an issue publication, and on Iraq, we have been very critical of the lack of courage of so many Democrats, one in the run-up to war, and today as we face the need to be responsive to those who voted in November 2006, believing they were voting in large measure to end this war. But we're critical, and you know, we're critical in pushing and challenging the limits. I wrote a blog a few weeks ago, Bob, just saying, you know, it's an interesting moment where I think the conservative movement is in crisis, and that we should have more confidence about the ideas we have on the kind of left progressive side of the aisle. But what is also distressing, it seems to me, is that you know, as Democratic candidates sound more like populist, you know, there is a tension to income inequality, there's talk about universal health care, et cetera. you know, no leading presidential candidate is challenging a military budget that now equals the total amount spent by the rest of the world combined. And no leading candidate is really speaking about the need for a public investment agenda. I could go on. So there's that sense of challenging, of pushing, and finally of also trying to open up a system which, in our view, doesn't allow for the full representation of the richness of voices and ideas in this country. So too often, because we have an electoral system, for example, we have a kind of downsized politics of excluded alternatives, and that's something that is of great interest and concern and, you know, for the magazine.
Our guest, Katrina VandenHeuvel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine, has been the editor since 1995, publisher since 2005, joining us from New York City from her office today. We're recording this shortly before going on air, so please don't call and sit back, relax, let Katrina and I do the yakking today. One of the debates recently in the pages of the Nation, or on the webpage certainly, where I've been refollowing it just recently, has been the decision by Cindy Sheehan to run as an independent against Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, the liberal Democrat from San Francisco. And this seems to have created, you know, the sort of debate where The Nation finds itself, where big chunks of its readership are on both sides of the debate.
You're absolutely right. And this is why we may start a section in the magazine, sort of, I hate to state it crudely, but sort of point, counterpoint, or different, you know, matters of opinion. Because what struck me, Bob, and I hope your listeners will go to our website, it is there, I think the title is Cindy Sheehan's Political Ambitions, and what it is a dialogue. Kath Apollett, our inimitable columnist, wrote a straightforward column praising Cindy Sheehan for her extraordinary work as an activist, as a peace activist, but raising a question about her independent race to challenge Nancy Pelosi in San Francisco. John Nichols, our incomparable Washington correspondent, though John is everywhere, not just in Washington.
Well, also, he's on the show all the time, too, so our listeners are well aware of him.
John is extraordinary. John has, I think, the greatest, he has a sense of history and politics, which is unrivaled in my view. But John has written two or three blogs about, supportive of Cindy Sheehan's race and the value, raising the importance of her, the value of her challenging Nancy Pelosi. So, you know, there you have it. I mean, you have two of the leading members of the Nation with different points of view within a spectrum of values and principles. And I guess I was saddened when Cindy Sheehan sent us a letter. You know, she recognized how we value her. We had her on the cover of our magazine, Bob, in March 2005, mm-hmm. before she became the Cindy Sheehan who confronted President Bush and Crawford. But she felt that it was a matter of, you know, that our, first of all, she didn't take into account John's supportive blogs about her race and asserted that we were supporting Nancy Pelosi. I mean, it was, and also that, you know, that we were in the pocket of the Democrats. And I think Cindy Sheehan misunderstood, as I wrote in my reply to her, that, you know, we have criticized Democrats, Republicans, and independents for failing to adequately oppose this administration and its bloody, misguided war. And also, I think, you know, we're a magazine, Bob. We want to cover movements. We ally with movements in different ways, but we're not a movement. And I think she misunderstood the magazine's role in our politics, which is really, you know, to be part of a discussion and a pluralism of views. So, you know, on impeachment, Bob, this magazine has different points of view, too. I mean, I think that John Nichols lays out the case for impeachment as well as anyone. I think he has done it masterfully on the Bill Moyers program, which was a terrific moment in our sad broadcasting history. And I think he's, you know, done it in our pages. We were the first, I'll never forget, I guess it was now 2 years ago after I read the stories about warrantless wiretapping, illegal wiretapping. I called Elizabeth Holtzman and I said, we had an ongoing discussion about impeachment. I said, I think now's the time. And we did a cover story, which was then a Nation mm-hmm. book. And I think, you know, there are different points of view, but the magazine supports that this process move as it should. It shouldn't be taken off the table, and one can be critical of Nancy Pelosi for saying that, but it should move in a rigorous process And mm-hmm. perhaps it begins with Cheney, I think, as John has suggested. You begin to see the signatures on that. And one thing we really take on is the policing, the kind of policing of permissible discourse, which we see in our mainstream media. When a Kucinich, for example, champions impeachment, and the Washington Post treats him like he's some fourth grader misunderstanding what he's up to, when in fact Denis Kucinich is someone who understands the Constitution better than the Washington Post.
Yeah, Katrina, let me, Katrina Vandenhoeven, let me just, because that's a point I wanted to get at with Denis Kucinich. One of the things that I find interesting is that the mainstream news media that covers the presidential race, for example, there are, to my knowledge, roughly eight announced Democratic candidates. And a couple of them, and specifically Kucinich, who's a member of the House of Representatives, been elected several times, has been relegated to sort of the back bench in the race and is not a serious candidate. Even when Tom Harkin had his steak fry in Iowa not too long ago, Kucinich and Gravel were not invited. All the other candidates were. And what does that do for you as the editor of The Nation if the mainstream media is dismissing Denis Kucinich and Gravel, even though I think on their positions they're probably closer to the heart of The Nation and its vast readership than any of the other candidates, or certainly no further away from The Nation? Do you feel like you need to cover them more? Do you say, well, if these guys really don't have a chance, I should be putting my energy, we should be putting our energy into those candidates who actually do have a chance, because that's what our readers are really interested in. They're not, you know, they want to know who's got an opportunity to win. How do you play something like that?
It's a good question. I mean, we haven't given Denis enough attention. We plan to in this next period. We have a number of people writing about his campaign, same with Gravel, but there is a tendency to focus our attention and our criticism and our pushing the front-running candidates to speak more clearly on the burning issues of our time. I think Denis deserves more coverage. What we prefer to do in terms of Denis is always bring it back to how he's at the forefront of the ideas we champion. It's not a horse race coverage with Denis, nor should it be a horse race coverage with any of these candidates, which I think the mainstream lapses into, which is why they marginalize Denis and Gravel. But we don't want to get into Denis's chances, you know, handicapping that. That's not the value of Denis's candidacy. It's the issues and the ideas that he brings to the race. But we need to, we need more self-criticism here, but we need to do more to cover what Denis is bringing into this race. And Mike Gravel, though I think Denis, I feel, is getting the short end of the stick on that one, because Gravel is, again, a more kind of outsized character.
Yeah.
You know, and has a little more of the kind of the humor that Denis, and I don't blame Denis, these are times which may not bring out all the humor in people.
Mm-hmm.
But he really, on it, and you know, when we think through our endorsement, which we will be doing, Bob,
mm-hmm.
you know, Denis is on almost every position. I can't think of a position we're not aligned with him on.
Yeah.
He's probably more visionary in the sense that the Department of Peace, you know, is something that requires a leap of vision and faith.
Mm-hmm.
which he has taken over these many years.
You know, one of the great developments, Katrina Vandenhoeven, over the past, say, 5 years has been the growth of what's called the Netroots, the Daily Coast, the blogosphere, the move-ons, and the ability of citizens at the grassroots to get involved politically via the Internet. And this has become a real development, especially in liberal democratic politics, where organized citizens, and the Dean campaign, I think, in 2004 was held up as a testament to the power of small contributors and grassroots organizing via the Internet, what's called the Netroots. And Jeff Cohen, not too long ago, the founder of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, wrote an interesting article. I don't know if you saw it.
I did see it. I thought it was very interesting. I'm sorry, Bob. You were going to...
Well, just for the sake of our listeners, I want you to comment on it. He argued that for all the talk about the Netroots and its commitment to, like, making the Democratic Party stay true to its stated principles, it seems to be a complete failure so far in pushing the debate past Hillary Clinton, who is acknowledged as basically the standard bearer for the Wall Street wing of the party.
I thought it was a fascinating blog Jeff wrote, and I think it's largely true. I do think I was reading Matt Bai's book, The Argument, which, mm-hmm. you know, your listeners may want to check out. What struck me about that, he had an interesting line at one point about how so many of the bloggers, history begins for them in 2000.
Yeah.
You know, and that, and the Clinton years are not on their radar. Now, you don't want to put Hillary Clinton squarely in her husband's administration, but at the same time, because you have so many of the same people around her, you can certainly begin to look back at the Clinton administration, one, and think hard about the Wall Street influence in this Hillary Clinton campaign.
Mm-hmm.
I do think the Netroots have a great democratizing impulse, as you said. It does open up the public sphere to people who can get past the gatekeepers, but the risk is that some of the Netroots people are becoming new gatekeepers, and in that process, some are, you know, there's that revolving door which we've seen in other aspects of our politics, Bob, so some of the key Netroots people have links to some of the Democratic campaigns, and then,
yeah.
of course, the Netroots, as you know, one reason for Move On's power, or one reason for, you know, is the ability to raise money.
Yeah.
And that's tricky, because that's not, you know, that's, they're, and the real journalism is, you know, with rare exceptions, I mean, I think a Josh Marshall of Talking Points Memo is doing some muckraking, but you're not looking at real journalism. It's riffing off of what's in mainstream media or in print press or in other mm-hmm. outlets, and I think that's valuable to hold the MSM accountable, but at the same time, it's not going to set us free, the Netroots. I mean, that's going to require more prodding, more pushing, and more willingness to take on the leading Democratic candidates. So I think he was onto something important. On the other hand, you have to give credit to a lot of the groundswell for opposition to this war
mm-hmm.
coming from the Internet.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, unfortunately, it's not as much in the streets as we would like, but there's certainly powerful sentiments, views on the Internet. And Hillary Clinton may not be, Bill Moyers once had a great line, he wrote for us in The Nation earlier this year about how, you know, so many Democrats are more like weather vanes. You know, are you a weather vane or, you know, they don't know the difference between a weather vane and a compass. Well, in the case of Hillary Clinton, she may be a weather vane, but she's, you know, adept at moving. And I think that the Internet has pushed her in some ways, as has public opinion.
Our guest, Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine based out of New York. If you don't have a subscription yet, you might want to check it out. Go to thenation.com, where you can also find her weblog, Editor's Cut, which she... You write pretty once a week at least, don't you, for that?
Yeah, I write a few times a week.
Yeah. There's a lot of entries there, and it's well worth your attention if you haven't seen it yet. This is a recorded show, so please do not call in. Sit back, relax, and let Katrina Vandenhoevel and yours truly, Bob McChesney, do the talking here in WILL AM 580. Katrina, you know, you mentioned earlier something that I think is now increasingly being understood across the political spectrum, which is that the sort of the conservative moment of the last generation – if it isn't coming to a complete halt, it's awfully close to the lip of the canyon and falling off. The conservatism and the Republican Party is sort of the embodiment of it in the United States, is in a real moment of crisis thanks to the war and probably a variety of other issues. And this is opening us enormous opportunity for the Democrats. And, you know, as you look at the presidential field and look at the three – or four people who are considered the prime contenders, and the ones I suspect that the nation will be looking at very closely as you determine your who to endorse. And I think your endorsement will be very important for a lot of people. What's your offhand take on Clinton, Obama, and Edwards?
Well, let me just, you know, if I could pick up on what you said. I do think, you know, when The Economist magazine, for example, has a cover, as it did a few weeks ago, is America turning left?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's an interesting moment because the magazine concluded that the American people, you know, were reacting to the conservative overreach, to
mm-hmm.
put it mildly, by turning left. I'm not quite sure, as you know, Bob, when people use the word left, I think back to the old Crossfire where Michael Kinsley represented the left, right?
And in that Economist piece, it was interesting that at the end of the piece, they reassured their listeners, don't worry, Hillary Clinton's not really on the left.
I know. I mean, and you know, the idea that Move On is this extreme ultra-left organization, all of these things, you know, you sort of have to take with a big grain of salt. But I do think we're at a moment where conservatism has come to a screeching halt. I mean, and I it's in shambles. The war, metastasizing corruption, the response to Katrina. And so I think that's happening on the one side. But on the other, I do think, you know, the Democratic Party is benefiting from that. But is it really crafting its own way? I think, you know, we've talked, there are many lefts and there are different Democratic parties. So what may happen in 2008, Bob, just on the Senate side, you may see, it's not fanciful, you might get to 60 Democratic seats in the Senate.
Well, if they win all the close races like they did in 06, that's
they
possible.
Might. Yeah, no, I mean, at the moment, and Robert Dreyfus has a good article for us next week about the GOP's Iraq problem. The GOP has 22 Senate seats up for grabs next year, and many of them are from states like Oregon, Minnesota, New Hampshire, Maine, New Mexico, which are hotbeds of anti-war sentiment. But, you know, what? As I said earlier, I do think it's encouraging. And again, this comes not from leadership by the Democratic Party, but comes from a movement from below, comes from a groundswell of understanding the realities in this country, that you are having a very serious conversation about health care, right? I mean, that is on the agenda. It's one of the paramount issues of this campaign. You, as I said earlier, do have a kind of populist moment with attention to inequality and to this gilded age obscenity of, you know, inequality. But at the same time, you don't see among the front-running candidates the boldness that would be, that's almost, you know, required as commensurate with the challenges
faces
the country.
I know that if John Edwards were on the line with us, and he isn't, but if were he on the line with us, he would take exception to that.
You know, I think John Edwards, it's interesting, Bob, if we did a straw poll at The Nation right now, John Edwards would be among the front-running candidates, because I think, you know, again, Kucinich and his ideas are so in sync with The Nation's. But John Edwards has tried to speak and has spoken to the need for big ideas for fundamental change. At the same time, you know, he's limited by a system that doesn't, I don't think a presidential race allows one to break through with, you know, the big ideas.
Mm-hmm.
That's not where you're going to build the big progressive politics. It needs different legs and pieces to it, as you well know.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think he's the one who's pushed and led. He's led on health care. He's led on attention to inequality and has had a strong populist response to that in a way that neither Hillary Clinton nor Barack have. Though, interestingly, Hillary, even with her Wall Street advisors, you know, she's talking the talk a little more. And, in fact, all of these candidates are not where they were, as you well know, Bob, you know, 10 years ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because on the trade issue.
Yeah.
People have moved. People have moved because the realities have shifted. And you can't stick with what were once sort of centrist Democratic Party shibboleths. So I think it's, but again, I come back to what I was saying. You know, you don't have, with the exception of Edwards, who has a big public investment agenda, but, you know, you don't have Edwards talking about a Medicare for all kind of single-payer national health care program, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and you don't have any of the candidates talking about how we have to exit this failed war on terror. I mean, John Edwards comes close in saying it's only a bumper sticker, but they're all within a framework of saying, well, we have to get out of Iraq because our resources are being diverted from Afghanistan, right?
And if I can interrupt on that point, because this is something I want to talk about in the show, which The Nation is concerned about, I know you're concerned about, which is the prospective attack on Iran.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Democrats haven't really been outspoken in a position critical of the Bush administration there, to my knowledge.
I think that's right. I think you're seeing quiet on that front at a moment when, at a minimum, the leading Democratic candidates should be demanding, at a minimum, that there be no action taken without an authorization. from Congress. You're not even seeing that demand stated as clearly. What's interesting, Bob, is that you could have a candidate operating in the framework of public, majority public opinion. Recent polls in the aftermath of this disastrous war, which is still ongoing, war and occupation, show that a majority of Americans now seek non-military solutions to crises and are very wary of resorting to military action as a first resort. A candidate could work with that and could be very clear about the disaster. Put aside, you know, the moral or argument, but the disaster of invading another country.
You know what's ironic and along those lines, Katrina, is I think that candidate would find there'd be a lot of people in the military would be delighted to have a politician saying that.
Exactly. I mean, you have a military which is livid. I mean, you can hear it, whether it's, you know, Admiral Fallon. There are people at the top levels, and we did an article about this last year called The General's Revolt, who, if anyone has undermined the military, it's this administration by recklessly stretching it as thin as it has. So there's a lot to work with. At the same time, the Democrats, and some of this is the right-wing media machine, the spin, the messaging, so skittish still about being called weak on terror. Look what they did when they left Washington in July. Was it July, Bob? When they, you know, caved quickly on the wiretapping.
Yeah.
The FISA, the Federal Intelligence Surveillance Board issue. I mean, that's a measure of how we haven't come far enough, because we should be at a point where you can see through the fear-mongering.
You know, can I just – what is your take on the invasion of Iraq, the prospects of it? There's really quite
of Iran?
Excuse me. There's quite a bit of debate here, ranging from that it's impossibly absurd to that it's all but certain. Where do you fall on that spectrum?
I think there's a – I mean, this is no – I don't have any great insight. There is a battle raging inside the administration between more pragmatic people and the Cheney forces, the remnants of the neocon forces, and in the backdrop. And how can one not, you know, see that Israel is involved to a certain extent? I mean, just last week, wasn't it, Israel did some bombing forays into Syria?
Yeah.
Was that laying the groundwork for more activity in the region? I think what's also distressing, just a media story, Bob, which I plan to write about, is the attacks on Mohammed al-Baradei. Your listeners may remember that in the run-up to war, he is the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, which got it right. I mean, we know that there was no imminent threat from Iraq. And even if there had been some weapons of mass destruction, inspection was the way to handle it, not this insanity of invasion and occupation. But al-Baradei got it right. For getting it right, he got the Nobel Peace Prize, I believe it was the Nobel Peace Prize. For getting it right, he's also incurred the wrath of the Bush administration, and the media has been on his case recently because he is trying to say we need to continue negotiating with Iran. They're years away from a nuclear weapons program, and what we're doing is exacerbating and compounding through this regime change talk. And al-Baradei is making some progress in getting Tehran to be more accountable. So I think the media coverage, particularly an odious Washington Post editorial about a week ago, which called al-Baradei a kind of rogue operator. That he was like, you know, not falling in the line as he should. So I think you're seeing a media narrative emerge.
Yeah.
And you know that. Michael Gordon and some of the reporting he's done, we want to do a story on that out of, the stories about Iraqi weapons into Iranian weapons into Iraq. But just commonsensically, putting aside the ideological neocon madness, the idea of invading Iran, the oil prices, and I'm just talking here about establishment opposition, right? You got Wall Street going berserk on that one. The military, a military that is so overstretched already, it doesn't know where to turn. Now, of course, the Navy, I mean, airstrikes would be involved, but, you know, you're not going to occupy another country. And then what Iran might do...
Plus a huge country.
It's a huge country.
And 70 million people.
It's huge. It's a young country. And you have these weapons, the installations are dispersed around the country. And then you have the fact that the Iraqi government in power is so close to the Iranian government. What would Iran do to U.S. soldiers in Iraq in retaliation, which is a horrifying thought? I think what you need to do is just think hard about the repercussions, the consequences, in a region that is already destabilized. So one hopes that there's some sanity, but you know what, when this comes to this administration, particularly Dick Cheney, who is the architect of so much, never say never.
You know, sometimes you think Dick Cheney watched Dr. Strangelove and came to the exact opposite conclusion than that he should have.
Well, I keep, Terry Southern, who wrote Dr. Strangelove, wrote for The Nation, mm-hmm. and he passed away before this administration came to power. I keep thinking how he would be tearing his hair out because he wouldn't know what to do because these characters have made Dr. Strangelove seem so quiet and normal. I mean, Rumsfeld, was beyond Dr. Strangelove and the surreal nature of some of his comments. By the way, your listeners should know I think Rumsfeld is setting up a foundation to train future leaders and promote democracy.
Well, we'll keep tabs on that.
That's a Terry Southern satire in heaven.
That really is. You know, we've only got a couple of minutes left, not even that. And I do want to briefly raise, real quickly, you mentioned Israel's role in being supportive of some attack on Iran, or they have a hostile relationship with Iran. And I know that my good friend Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive, and his predecessor, Irwin Knoll, The Progressive, both of them told me personally how – when The Progressive took a stance that was sympathetic to the Palestinians and critical of Israel, that it really cost them a great deal in terms of subscriptions and getting all sorts of attacks. And you know, you're running a publication where I would imagine you're in the exact same line of fire. How is covering Israel and Palestine, how do you handle that at The Nation?
It is one of the most difficult issues we face because it's one of the great taboos in our country. This is where we part ways with the Democrats, almost all of them, because they, are so enthralled to AIPAC, which is the leading, powerful American Jewish organization, which, by the way, all polls show does not represent the views of a majority of Jews in this country. As I sit here in our conference room, Bob, Akiva Elder, a wonderful Jewish columnist and writer for the Israeli paper Haaretz, is speaking to our staff. We just did a piece about Haaretz, which I hope your listeners will find. The debate in Haaretz is not to be found in our mainstream press. Haaretz, Israeli paper, has very tough criticism of the Israeli government's policies in the occupied territories and toward the Palestinians. Until there is justice for the Palestinians, until there is a fair peace process, which I fear the United States can no longer really take on without massive international support, because we're not perceived as an honest broker, to say the least, there will not be security for Israel in the region. You know, we do get angry letters from people who feel that we are unfair to Israel, but I think that we are trying to be the honest broker that we don't see in our politics or in so much of the media, and to give voice to the voiceless in our media. We have some very smart correspondents in Israel and in the occupied territories, and we rely on them for some tough reporting. I mentioned earlier about Haaretz. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that reporting piece we did on the newspaper is an eye-opener for many people to understand that you can have spirited criticism and debate inside Israel, which if you had in this country would be treated as, quote, anti-Semitic. You cannot equate legitimate criticism of Israeli policies with anti-Semitism. And, I think, Walt Mearsheimer, your listeners may know of Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer, two centrist, realist political scientists.
I mean, they're
written
mainstream.
A book about the Israeli lobby.
Yeah.
You may have criticism of their book and that thesis because it's a little schematic in ways. But they, along with Jimmy Carter, our former president, and his work and his book on this issue, it's important to have that debate and to have these issues aired about the role Israel plays in the formulation of U.S. foreign policy and policy, and how do we think hard about U.S. national interest in relationship to our relationship with Israel. So, but we get a lot of angry letters. One article I'm very proud of is something we did in this last week's issue, which is about Jewish social justice activism, which gets mm-hmm. lost, because so much of the coverage of you know, of American Jews has to do with Israel, when in fact there's a whole great tradition which has, you know, been part of the left and progressive organizing, and I hope your listeners will pick that up by Peter Dreyer, looking at, you know, as I said, progressive organizing, the Jewish community.
You know, one of the, along these lines, this fall, Norman Finkelstein, of course, had to leave his position at DePaul University after a very public campaign in which he was engaged that involved Alan Dershowitz of Harvard. And that was just one of many incidents. Professor Walt, when he gave a lecture at the University of Montana as a guest lecturer, was given, a very strong campaign to not let him be allowed to come, or only be allowed to come if Alan Dershowitz was allowed to present a formal rebuttal.
These are scary. I think this is very frightening because this is a time for for intelligent discussion and for analysis, and not for conspiracy theories, and not for failing to listen to other points of view. And to, you know, we are seeing in the academy, you mentioned Norman Finkelstein, there's a case up at Columbia more recently, a tenure case where a woman who's done work on the Palestinians is having trouble. A lot of this also, as you know, Bob, goes on with, I think it's David Horowitz.
Mm-hmm.
David Horowitz, former lefty turned vigilante in many ways, goes on the internet. It goes on the internet where they're hounding people.
Yeah.
And they are hounding people and undermining the very American concept of academic freedom, of academic inquiry. And it's not a good turn in a country which is already, you know, beleaguered in terms of civil liberties and freedom of speech, and the erosion of those values and principles.
You know, if I could turn back, Katrina Vandenhoevel, to the issue of Iraq, because The Nation has covered this story and been on top of this story from the very beginning. And I recall, because John Nichols, as you know, is one of my best friends, and we talk all the time, and he was telling me about the debates over the invasion, whether The Nation would support the invasion, or how its position would be on the prospective invasion of Iraq in 2002. And John was telling me how impressed he was that the staff almost uniformly realized this was just not acceptable, that sort of all the conventional wisdom that was flooding the media culture right and left in the country wasn't really catching on at The Nation. And one of the stories that you at The Nation really helped advance that is now becoming more of a news story was the role of private contractors.
Yeah.
And it's to a degree that I think very few Americans, and certainly in the mainstream press, are really getting a sense of just how this sort of privatized war is different from previous wars. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. I think in terms of the run-up to war, Bob, I think there was something in the genetic code of The Nation, which, you know, we didn't lose our head. And we understood the folly and disaster this invasion and occupation might lead to. But the other, you know, it's not in the last couple years, Jeremy Scahill, wonderful muckraking, independent, as he likes to say, unembedded reporter,
mm-hmm.
has done some groundbreaking investigative work on one of the leading security contractors, but let me put it a different way, mercenary contractors, Blackwater.
Mm-hmm.
Blackwater was in the news a few years ago when four of its people were killed in Fallujah, but in a stunning move, the Blackwater contractors protecting a State Department convoy fired on a crowd and killed eight civilians. And, you know, we have been at the forefront of exposing this shadowy, ultra-secretive, unaccountable force, which, by the way, is the military, the U.S. military in Iraq, is the junior partner in this war. I mean, private contractors outnumber.
I know, it's astonishing.
It's astonishing. So when we talk about withdrawal, what has been important, and Jeremy has been taking the lead, he's testifying later this week, by the way, in front of Reid and Dorgan's committee in the House, and he's testified before and tried to push legislation which would end this practice, but also the whole issue of accountability is just obscene. I mean, these contractors, if you listeners read the paper the other day and the coverage of this crisis and horror, one of the first pieces of legislation passed with the new constitution was that these private contractors would not be held accountable under Iraqi law.
Oh, my God.
And I don't think they're accountable under U.S. law. I mean, we've seen some of the war profiteering and, of course, contractor abuse and the torture scandals. So I think it's emerged in the last 10, 12 years. Ken Silverstein wrote for us years ago about the emerging outsourcing and privatization of the military. But it's taken on huge new proportions in Iraq. And I think we're at risk of, you know, losing our democracy if we have an outsourced, privatized military, unaccountable to our often not-so-wise leaders, but just unaccountable, you know, in any sense to the citizens of this country. Well, that's at stake.
Well, that's certainly the argument of Chalmers Johnson, who writes for The Nation on this issue and has written books and been a guest on this program, that this is all part of sort of the lack of constitutional oversight of the military infrastructure in this country. In his view, the end of the republic, for all intents and purposes. You know, one of the other stories related to this that The Nation's been key in breaking has been the idea that these sort of crises around the world, like Iraq, instead of being accidents that planners don't really like, in fact, are really necessary to provide investment opportunities and profit opportunities for large firms like the Blackwaters of the world and the Halliburtons. And Naomi Klein, who's written for The Nation at length, has a new book just coming out on this shock.
The Shock Doctrine.
And you really, I think The Nation was the publication that gave that the first chance to be aired in the United States. What do you make of her thesis, and what is her thesis?
You know, she launched her, the U.S. book. It's published, by the way. The book is published in seven countries simultaneously. I think Naomi's one of the most original, important kind of geopolitical movement thinkers. Mm-hmm. What she did in The Nation in April 2003 was something no one else was doing in the context of Iraq, which is an argument which fits into her book, The Shock Doctrine. She was focused on how Iraq was being treated as a blank slate on which the most ideological Washington neoliberals were designing their dream economy. And it was a process, you know, from which the Iraqi people, of course, were entirely excluded, despite all the talk about their newfound freedom from tyranny at that time. And then in a cover story in 2005... she drew together that reporting on post-war Iraq and post-tsunami Asia to present what you mentioned just now, that kind of original startling thesis that institutions of modern global capitalism need these disasters. I mean, by throwing societies off balance and sending people into shock and systems into shock, disasters create this slate that can be filled with sort of Milton Friedman-esque shock therapy economic programs. I think it's a very important argument, and I think she's done it rigorously with great research.
Well, on that note, Katrina Vandenhoevel, I do hear the band tuning up in the background. It means they're going to clear me out of the studio. I want to thank you, Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine, thenation.com, for joining us today on Media Matters. And I want to thank Mike Pritchard for being my producer. See you all in 167 hours.